Book 7, Towards Calvary. Chapter 1, But Where Are the Nine? The resurrection of Lazarus had profound repercussions. Historically, it led directly to the death of Jesus. Some of the people who had witnessed the miracle told the Pharisees what they had seen. The Pharisees passed the information to the council, and from now on, it was the Sanhedrin itself which took steps for the apprehension of Jesus. The Sadducees were more concerned with the political effect of the miracle. Lazarus seems to have been a prominent man. The Passover was near. They could not ignore the possibility of an insurrection which would bring upon them the retribution of Rome and lead to their own downfall. Caiaphas, the high priest, cast aside the querulous arguments in the council chamber and summed up the matter in clear, cold logic. "You know nothing at all. Nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not." The beloved Apostle John, looking back upon these days many years later, spoke of the prophetic nature of these words, but showed also their double application in the great redemption which was to be achieved in gathering together in one all the children of God. Meanwhile, the council of the high priest was confirmed, and action immediately followed. It was determined to arrest Jesus and put him to death. Any man knowing his whereabouts was to report to them immediately. As the preparation began for the final Passover, Jesus left the city and went northwards into the mountainous country near the town of Ephraim and stayed there with his disciples. This retirement would afford him the last opportunity for solitary communion with God. It would also give him time to prepare the disciples for the events of the coming week. Although in his love and understanding, he was to make careful arrangements that his final exhortation and encouragement should be reserved for the few hours before his arrest. There was little interruption in this mountainous country. Although the Passover was approaching, the pilgrims were keeping well to the east, avoiding the Samaritans. The little company had reached the borders that divided Samaria from Galilee, and were approaching a village when their attention was drawn to a group of men. As they drew near, it was evident that in spite of their anxiety to attract attention, they were also anxious to keep their distance. Over the still air came the concerted cry, "Jesus! Master! Have mercy on us!" It was evident that Jesus had come across one of those colonies of lepers that were dotted over Palestine. They huddled together in a common bond of loathsomeness. Jew and Samaritan knew no enmity here. One of the many distressing features of leprosy is the failure of the voice. But under the stress of their need, these 10 men made themselves heard. Steadily, Jesus drew near. "Go," he said, "show yourselves to the priests." Once more, we wonder at the way in which Jesus suited his instruction to the needs of those who came to him. His was no conventional healing. He was always more conscious of the spiritual need than the bodily infirmity. The 10 men looked down at their scarred and pitted flesh. There was no sign of a cure. Yet this man was telling them to act as though they had been cleansed. Here was a call to faith, not in words, but in deed. They turned and began their journey towards the village, and Luke records, "As they went, they were cleansed." Presently Jesus saw one man coming towards him, a man who was excited. His features were not familiar. His clear complexion gave no indication that here was one of the pitiable wrecks who had stood before him less than half an hour ago. When he spoke, his tone was strong, full of thankfulness. With a loud voice, he glorified God, and, reaching Jesus, he fell at his feet, giving thanks. There was no need for Jesus to look up and scan the countryside. He knew this man was alone. Were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? No, only the Samaritan had returned to give thanks. Not far away, the other 9 were rejoicing in their release, but they had forgotten the source of their healing. "Go thy way," said Jesus, "thy faith hath made thee whole." The Samaritan had been more deeply cured than his fellows. The word of the Lord had penetrated beneath his scaly flesh and touched his heart. How often our plaintive cry is heard before the throne of grace. Yet when responsive blessings flow, how many retrace their steps to Jesus, and falling at his feet, glorify his Father? Thankfulness rendered to God and manifested in our action towards men is as rare as it is seemly. Sometimes a Samaritan teaches us the lesson. When Jesus reached the adjacent village, he found the people dumbfounded at the sight of the lepers in their midst. The Pharisees, obviously impressed, came up and asked him when the kingdom of God should come. But it was too late to ask that now. In a few days' time, the Passover will be held, and the king will be crucified. It cannot now come with observation. Men will no longer be able to say, "Lo here," or "Lo there," for behold, he said, "the kingdom of God is in your midst." The disciples were puzzled by his words, and so Jesus explained them. The time was at hand when they would desire to see the days of the Son of Man, but would not see them. He was to suffer many things and be rejected of this generation. But the day would come when the Son of Man would be unmistakably revealed in his kingdom. For as the lightning that lighteth out of the one part under heaven shineth unto the other part under heaven, so also shall the Son of Man be in his day. He spoke to them of the dangers and the false alarms prior to his coming. He exhorted them to be loyal and courageous. Their attitude in the difficult days ahead was to be one of prayer. He told them the parable of the unjust judge, who was pestered by the constant pleadings of a poor woman. After many refusals, he finally righted her wrong, because her repeated visits were bothering him. "And shall not God," said Jesus, "avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, although he bear long with them?" About this time, Jesus noticed, probably in the larger body of his disciples, a marked degree of self-righteousness among some. It was made more distressing by a tendency to despise their fellows. To these, Jesus addressed a parable, conveying a pointed lesson for all who suffer from a presumptuous imagination of their righteousness. Two men went into the temple to pray, the one a Pharisee and the other a publican. To the Pharisee, this was a cherished occasion. Majestically, he walks towards the most prominent place, and satisfied that he is conspicuous, he begins his prayer. His rich voice echoes resonantly through the temple. "God, I thank thee," he begins with apparent reverence, but it is evident that this approach is only a means to his own glorification. "I thank thee that I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers." He looks around him complacently. His eye rests upon the humble figure of a publican, almost hidden in the shadows, a figure pathetic in its self-effacement, head bowed, hands beating upon breast in an agony of penitence. Nor even is this publican. He relates his virtues. "I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess." In his abundant righteousness, he condescends to offer more than God desires, but he is entirely oblivious that the very things he offered were designed to emphasize his poverty and need. His prayer concluded, he makes his slow, self-satisfied, important way from the temple. He has had his reward. He has prayed with himself. His words have echoed round the temple and have reached his ears again, bringing a complacent smile to his lips. But God has not heard his words. He is listening to the heartbroken cry of the publican, "Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner." Though he stood afar off in the shadows of the temple, he was near to God. He was learning that God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. And learning this, peace was gently flowing into his heart. He went back to his house justified. "Everyone," said Jesus, "that exalts himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted." It was singularly appropriate at this time that parents should bring their children to him to be blessed. Their simple trust made a satisfying contrast to the sufficiency of man. But the disciples knew how tired Jesus was. They also thought they knew that he was preoccupied with sterner problems. Such an interruption was therefore undesirable. They discouraged the mothers, rebuking their eagerness, dismissing their children. How little they understood him! Can we not see the tired eyes light up with joy, the stern lines on his face soften? Gladly he took them in his arms and blessed them. Surrounded by happy children and contented mothers, he looked at his disciples. "Suffer little children to come unto me, and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. Verily I say unto you, whosoever shall not receive the kingdom of God as a little child, shall in no wise enter therein.